It's a pleasure to introduce Daniel Friedman, who is a professional engineer with a degree in engineering and physics from the University of British Columbia. He grew up in Chile, and the family moved to Vancouver when he was a teenager, and he worked his way up to become the president and CEO of McDonald Wilter & Associates, Canada's leading aerospace company. It's a multi-billion dollar company. And he just retired as the CEO a few months ago, and he's still working with the company on, I guess, a consulting business. His interest in cosmology and space has led him to study the intersection between Genesis, Bereshit, between science and Torah, and he's written a couple books. He has another book, you know, coming out. He's been studying it, and now that he's sort of left the company, he can devote more time. So he's going to be giving, you know, two talks on the interface between Bereshit and science. And I just want to thank Steve Mayer, who introduced us to the connection to Toronto. I want to thank him for helping bring him to Toronto, and our pleasure to welcome you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi. I will be using slides, so if you can't see them, maybe you can come closer to the middle. It'll be easier to follow if you can see a couple of the slides at least anyway. Well, thank you very much for coming. I encourage you to ask me questions of clarification as we go along. We're a small enough group. I don't have to just have a monologue here. If there's something you're not understanding, let me know. I'll try and explain it. If you have a big question, philosophical questions, which I'm sure there's a lot on this topic, let's save it to the end. I will try and leave 10 minutes at the end to ask other questions. So a week ago, it's good timing, a week ago we read Bereshit, and we're told there that God created everything in 6 days. And the last creation was man. And then from that point on, from Adam's creation or birth, we count our Jewish calendar. So the sixth day is Rosh Hashanah. It's Adam's birthday. And we've counted 5,777 years. So our chronology is 6 days of creation, followed by approximately 6,000 years. I don't want to keep saying 5,777, so I'll say approximately 6,000. And that's our chronology for the creation. So everything is roughly 6,000 years old if you take the Torah literally. And when you go through Genesis, you can extract a fair number of items. I've extracted 17. I'm just using a few here. But we know the time from the beginning, Bereshit, till now. So that's the age of the universe. We know that the sun and the moon were made in day 4, so we know the time for the sun and the moon. We know the plants, animals, humans, and so on. So you read through the Genesis text all of those dates. And here is the issue that we're here to talk about. Science has, in the meantime, gone on its own merry way to try and determine what the timeline is where everything came into being. And they've come up with very different answers. So science has come up with the universe being 13.8 billion years old. That's a million times older than 6,000 years. Come up with the sun being 4.5 billion years old. First life in the oceans being 3.5 billion years ago. And even humans being 200,000 years old, humans that look like us. We'll talk about humans in the next hour. Which is a more difficult subject, so I'm going to try and kind of talk about the first 5.5 days of creation and leave the second half of the sixth day till the next one. So I will go over where science gets these numbers because one of the answers is science is wrong. But I'm going to spend most of my time on Torah because that's what we're here to talk about. And I will try and address this issue. And of course, at the end, we've got to talk about the real question, which is science thinks they have a natural, two natural theories to explain all this, and we read in Bereshit that God did it all. The natural theories don't talk about God in them. It's all natural. So that's our topic. It's a big topic around the world. Even though in Canada we don't talk a lot about it, it's called the creation evolution debate. It's called the origins debate. It's very big in the States. It's very big in Israel, in Turkey, in South America, and so on. And people are fairly polarized about it. About 40% of the U.S. population, that's the only statistics I have, unfortunately, believe in the Torah side of this argument, the literal side, like the world is 6,000 years old, period. The science is all wrong. The flood changed everything. Forget all the science numbers. 40% of the U.S. population. Not a Jewish poll, a general population poll. 15% believe the science numbers and the science theory, i.e. no God, atheists. And the ones in between, whatever the 35% or so, believe the science numbers, but believe that God did it all within those science numbers. So we have all those points of, just so you know where people are at on this issue. Are we clear on that? Okay. The first thing I'm going to try and do is to spend one slide on science, because I want you to not answer that science is wrong so that we can have the rest of the lecture, because it wouldn't be any fun if science is wrong. So one of the things that's really important to understand, and it's not clear in the textbooks that our children are reading in the schools, that they're studying in the schools here. I spoke in the schools here on Friday, so certainly in the public schools. It's not clear in those texts, and it's certainly not clear in the public television programs that the people watch. But there's two parts to science. One part is observational. I go out there, and I pick up a rock, as somebody did about 200 years ago in England, happened to be a priest and a geologist at the same time, and I see that that rock is way older than 6,000 years for a variety of methods. That's just straight observation. There's no theory there. So we have observations. Almost all the numbers I'm going to show you today from science are based on observation. Now comes somebody else and says, okay, you've observed all that. I'm going to make a theory to explain it. And the definition of science is I'm going to make that theory godless. I'm going to make that theory all nature. But the numbers that we're arguing about don't, in general, come from theory. They come from direct observation. And I'll give you a few examples in a minute. So the numbers are very hard to argue with. And so first we're going to talk about what science has measured and what the Torah says. And at the end we're going to get into the how. Is it our belief system or why is science being so successful? So we have two basic ways and two timelines. One is the study of cosmology, which is a fancy word for studying how the universe came to be, which is kind of the first 4 days in Genesis, all the way through to the sun, solar system. And then, of course, in day five, Genesis starts with life. So in the study of cosmology, we put up all kinds of telescopes. We look at all the cosmos. We put up a bunch of telescopes to look at the sun and really understand the sun. We've gone to the moon. We've gone to Mars. We've gone to Venus. We certainly tromped around Earth all over the place. And we put all this stuff together. And we've got direct measurements. I'll give you one example. We understand exactly what's going on in the sun. We've reproduced it on Earth in nuclear fusion reactions. And by looking at the sun, we know exactly how much hydrogen and helium there's there. So we can tell how far along that's been burning. It's like looking at your fireplace and saying, okay, it started with all wood. Now it's half wood, half ash. So it's going to burn another same amount of time until it's all ash and it's over. So the sun is about halfway through. It started as all hydrogen. Now it's half burnt out. In 4.5 billion years, and it's going to go forward. And we can calculate basically to the fifth decimal place how old the sun is. It's 4.57, I can't remember the other decimal place, billion years old, and so on. So that's how those numbers that I showed you in the previous slide are calculated. Then when it comes to life, we have the fossil record, which is a fancy word for every single thing we've discovered. We've discovered hundreds of thousands of bones of marine animals, land animals, things that look like humans, microscopic things, plants, of course. I have a picture there of a little extinct frog on a tunny. And we've also, of course, uncovered cave paintings. We'll talk a lot more about that in the next talk. pottery, tools, and so on. And that has nothing to do with evolution. That is just what we've discovered, and we can measure how old those things are for a variety of methods, which all kind of lead to the same general answers. And we can put together a timeline of everything that's ever existed. At this point, that frog existed, and then, you know, sometime later it didn't exist anymore because a lot of things have gone extinct. Dinosaurs, of course, are the most famous. So we can see in the fossil record, there's nothing. 3.5 billion years ago, bang, there's microscopic life in every ocean in the planet. We have fossils upon fossils upon fossils. Instantly, there's microscopic life. Then very little happens for a while, and about 500 million years ago, we've got animals swimming around in the ocean. And then we've got land animals and plants and so on and so forth. So we put a whole string together. Now, what Darwin tried to do, he didn't have the fossil record we have today. He had a fossil record of 100 and something years ago. He tried to explain that in a natural way. But that's what he was trying to explain. So that's a theory. This is measurement. And I'm sticking with measurement for now because theories cannot be proven correct or incorrect when they relate to things that happened a long time ago. They can be proven correct today, but not when it happened a long time ago. So that's the dating. So in science, we have a very detailed timeline starting 13.8 billion years ago until now of everything that happened in the cosmos, when the solar system came to be, when the sun came to be, the moon, the earth, and then we continue on when the first microscopic life was on earth, when the first life in the waters was on earth, all the way to us. And in our sense, when we started painting, when we started putting clothes on, and when we started doing agriculture, when we invented money, all those things are timelined in science. You can look it up in Wikipedia, very detailed. It goes page upon page upon page. It's been sorted out. So science has this tremendous timeline. And as that timeline from science was being developed, as I said, it started about 200 years ago when they discovered old rocks. As that timeline developed, this argument intensified and intensified and intensified. You know, what's going on? We have a completely different timeline in both scenarios. And then science started coming up with a successful theory and a more successful theory in the Big Bang and then later on in evolution to explain it all. And that's what's created it. What got me going into all this, and I'm happy to see lots of parents here, is that I give you the statistics of what people believe. But what I didn't tell you is that for the first time in history, in the last 5 or so years, there is a complete different set of answers from the 15 to 25-year-olds versus the 50 and up-year-olds. So before, when I gave you the statistics, they applied to the whole population. Today, the 50 and up side with Genesis, and the 15 to 25 side with science, because they've been through the school system that has, you know, made science, and the public TV system that has made science a bit of a hero. That's all I'm going to say about science. I just want you to remember that we have to deal with those measurements. They're for real. And we'll talk about the theory later at the end. But the measurements are there. So I know this thing is called a creation-evolution debate, but I don't even want to talk about that until we can reconcile 13 billion versus 6,000, because that's where the problem started. And that's where people can't get past. I'm going to switch to Torah. Anything needs to be clarified? Okay. So I describe what we read in Genesis. These quotations are all truncated because I wanted to make them readable, but I'll go over them. Genesis chapter 1 is 2,000 words long. So what I get from teenage kids is, you know, how can you even talk about this? Like, that's not even the preface to my biology book. But when you go into our oral Torah, when you go into the Talmud, into the Midrash, and certainly into the Kabbalah, you get to hundreds of pages on this story. And when you go to man, you get to thousands of pages. So despite the fact that the Torah is a book for how we should live, it does contain a fair amount of detail about how the universe came to be. Not, you know, 2,000 words, but hundreds and thousands of pages if you include man, which is the next topic. So we have a lot of detail. And I just want to give you a couple of examples so you can appreciate it that you may or may not be familiar with. The first one you might be familiar with. But in the Talmud, it tells us what happened in day 6, hour by hour. So we read the chronology last week. It said, you know, God made the body of Adam, and then he breathed his soul, and then he told him to name the animals and so on. But in the Talmud, we're told by the hour. So in the first hour, God gathered the dust. He's made from his body's made from the dust of the ground. And it goes on. By the fourth hour, he's finished shaping the body. In the fifth hour, he breathes the soul into him. In the sixth hour, he tells him to name the animals. In the seventh hour, he cuts him in half, becomes Adam and Eve. Then they have kids, then he's commanded, then he sins, then he's judged, and then he's expelled just before Shabbos in the 12th hour. By the way, these 12 hours relate to the daylight hours. By and large, God doesn't work at night. There are exceptions, but he kind of works during the day. It's right in the Talmud. And as an aside, if we have time later, there's so many science books that ask themselves, how come nothing was going on for this period of time, and this period of time, and this period of time, and everything was going on here and here and here? It corresponds exactly to night when nothing's going on, and day when everything's going on. It's just fabulous. So we have that kind of precision. You can get higher precision. You go to the Midrash, one of my favorite ones, because I thought whoever wrote it down had a lot of guts, or he was talking directly to God that day. But, you know, he wrote down that the moon was completed less than two-thirds of an hour after the sun. Now, why would you write that down? That's just predicting the weather. You're bound to be wrong. It happens to be right, you'll see. So, you know, we're told in day four that they're both completed at the end of the day, but here we're given the detail that the moon, you know, he finished the sun, and then within two-thirds of an hour, he finished the moon. We have other sources that say that Adam sinned exactly 3 hours before Shabbos, not 2 hours and 59 minutes or 3:01, exactly 3 hours before Shabbos. So I spend a fair amount of time with the help of some rabbis that know a lot more than me about sources, putting together a timeline of from our Torah, including the Kabbalah, of what happened when. And I ended up so far with about 17 events. I don't have a couple hundred like science does, but I got 17 events. And two-thirds of those, we got down to the minute. Not to the day, not to the hour, to the minute. Other ones are like this one, are to within a fraction of an hour. So we have sources to create a timeline, just like science has created a timeline. Here's the beginning, here's the Milky Way, here's the sun and the moon, here's the first life in the oceans, here's the first big the first life in the oceans was microscopic. Here's the macroscopic life in the ocean, things you can see. Here's the life on land, the plants, the four-legged animals, and the humans. So we have our own timeline. Okay? So now I got the two timelines in kind of to the same precision. I don't have as many items, but I got it to the same precision. Is that clear what's been going on here, the two timelines? Okay? So either everybody's asleep or I'm being clear. We'll figure it out in a minute. So how do we go from here? Well, we go to the next source at the very bottom here. And we believe that the Torah pre-existed creation and that God looked into the Torah and made the universe. And that, therefore, that the Torah is the blueprint for creation. Now, this is not a foreign concept because we're commanded to look into the Torah and copy another Torah. We're not allowed to just do it from memory. So that's what he's doing. He's looking at the Torah and he's doing the universe. Yes?
Is the Torah a creation?
Oh, that's for a rabbi, but...
Can you repeat the question? It's
sure. Right. Is the Torah a creation? I'll leave that for a rabbi. What I know from the sources is that pre-existed this physical creation. We're told that clearly in the sources, that it pre-existed this physical creation. So we have an age group here that knows what a blueprint is, right? Everybody knows what a blueprint is? Good. When I talk to the kids, they look at me like I'm nuts. As you know, when you look at the blueprint for your house or for a building, it doesn't make a lot of sense, even for an engineer, until you notice on the right-hand bottom side that in the case of my house blueprint, 1 inch equals 10 feet. Once you have that scale, that 1 inch equals 10 feet, then everything you measure in the blueprint makes sense in the building, and everything you measure in the building makes sense in the blueprint. Without the scale, you're completely confused. It's just a bunch of lines, and you can't really tell. You might be able to tell the different rooms and so on, but you can't really tell. So I went looking for a scale for our blueprint. to see what it could do. So you'll recall back to Passover that God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm. You recall last week that God spoke the world into existence, that God breathed into Adam. And we're told very clearly in the 13 principles of faith that God has no physical or spiritual shape. So we got all these words in the Torah that talk about a physical and spiritual shape. And I first thought it was just an analogy. But that's not what the sources say. The sources say these words are absolutely correct. Every word in the Torah is absolutely correct. If you scratch a little bit of a letter, you're done with that until you fix that. So we are the analogy. So when it says God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm, we're supposed to look at one of these things that he doesn't have and try to understand what he might be meaning by that. And I'll give you the example of speaking, because that's the topic we're on right now. When I am speaking right now, I'll have to confess that there's thoughts going through my mind at full speed. I've been through the lecture about four times by now, back and forth in my head, and looking at my watch and calculating how long it's going to take and so on. But I'm keeping you away from all that, and I'm trying to come up with one word at a time in a particular sequence and order so that you can comprehend what I'm trying to say. And that's the process of speech. It's taking an infinite thought, because thoughts, you know, seem to be pretty infinite, and making something very finite and concise. And in that process, you lose a lot. You have to decide what your audience is and decide what level you're going to do that. So in Kabbalah, the process of creating the world for God is explained exactly the same way. God's infinite light is everywhere. And then he contracts his light away. And then in that space, he's able to put finite things. It's called the process of Tzimtzum, of contractions. And it's very similar to speech, but it's not speech. He didn't sit on top of a mountain and scream out the world. He did this process of contracting something infinite, himself, or his light, not himself, his light, and create finite things. So it's a bit of a sidetrack. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. What I want to show you is sometimes the words in the Torah are in our language, and that's a quote from Rambam, so that we can look at ourselves and try to understand what they might mean, because you can't talk about infinite concepts in writing or talking. So I propose that maybe a creation day, which is a very special thing, is not exactly a 24-hour day. Or if it is exactly a 24-hour day, what we are measuring may not be that through the scientific method. So we have a scale. And that day may mean something else, like an outstretched arm means something else, and like speech means constructions and so on. So my usual approach is to give you the answer and then explain it at the end, because we get stuck on that and we don't get to the how, which is a really important part of the talk. So if you're not happy with the answer, I'll come back and explain it at the end. I will leave a good 10 minutes at the end for questions and for that. So if we look in the Torah, we have at least three concepts of time. And by the way, in science, we have a lot of concepts on time. A nice Jewish boy called Einstein told us that if we're flying on a spacecraft and keeping time, and we're sitting down here, our twin sitting here keeping time, he's got a different clock. And neither one is right. Well, they both think they're right, but they're completely different. So that concept was in Torah already. You've seen in Psalms, it's in our prayers, that it says one day for God is 1,000 of our years. Have people seen that? Right? So we have this concept that there's a divine time, that's my middle time there, where one day is equivalent to 1,000 days in what I've called, for lack of a better word, human time, just to keep the term straight. So that concept's already there. And we have a creation day, which is not the same as a day in those other two concepts. So we have the 6 days, which are a very special period of time in the language. And then we have this notion that God keeps time differently. Of course, God is above time, but he had to create time, because if he didn't create time, we couldn't exist. It's one of the things he has to create. Just like I can't speak. If I speak it all at once, you'll never understand it. That did happen at Matan Torah for a bit, and it didn't work out. So Moses had to kind of give it out one by one. So we have these three concepts of time. And when I go looking for that, part of the answer to go from divine time to human time, that's the one day is 1,000 years, that's right in Psalms. The other one is the complicated one, is in the Kabbalah. And what you come up with is that one creation day is 1,000 times 7,000 times 365. The 365, and when I do the calculation, I put all the significant digits. It's not 0.25, it's 0.24, 8, 9, whatever it is. That's just a conversion from days to years. So it's really just two numbers, 1,000 times 7,000. And I'm not going to explain the 7,000 right now because I don't want to get sidetracked, but I point out two things to you. You've seen a ton of sevens in the Torah and a ton of ones. And when you... And this is a very simple number. It's just 1,000 and 7,000. You can't get 3.1415 out of it or some fancy scientific numbers. It's really simple. It's 1 times 7 and a bunch of zeros times 365. So I can't fudge what I'm about to show you because I can't make it 7,000 and 2.35 to make things work. It's 7,000 on it. So one creation day, 1,000 times 7,000 times 365. Now, a disclaimer here because I do get into trouble, especially with my rabbi. I'm not saying that a creation day is that. I'm saying that that's the scale in the Torah. So you can happily believe that the world is 6,000 years old and a creation day was 24 hours. But I want to know, when God looked into that blueprint, what did he make the world look like? The Rebbe, for example, Lubavitcher Rebbe, said that the world is 6,000 years old and God made it old. I don't know if you had your kids come home one day with completely worn out jeans that they just bought, right? You all ripped up and faded. You can buy old jeans that were made that, presumably that day. And whoever made those jeans tried to make them 3 years old or 5 years old or 10 years old by deciding how many washes they had to have and so on and so forth. So the creator of those jeans knew exactly that they were brand new, but they were supposed to look 3 years old. So one of the Jewish answers is that the world was made old. And when we're running around as scientists, we're getting confused by that. And that's fine. But if the blueprint was used to make the world, where's it saying the blueprint how old it was made? It has to say that. So, you know, if the blueprint for your house says, put a roof that looks 10 years old on it, I go and find some shakes that look 10 years old, I put it on the roof instead of new ones. Or you can believe that a day is like an arm or a breath, and it really means this. I'm happy either way. I'm trying to find the correlation between the blueprint and the creation. We are told in our sources very clearly we can understand the world from the Torah top down, or we can understand the word, most of the world, bottom up by looking at the creation. So that's what I'm trying to do. So when you multiply those three numbers, you get around two. Everything I have in the graph is exact, but I'm just going to use rounded numbers when I'm speaking to keep it simple. 2.5 billion years, but you'll see all the multiplications are done to many decimal places. That's an Excel spreadsheet, by the way. So you get 2.5 billion years. Okay? So I told you that I've gone to all the sources, hundreds of pages, and I put every item, 17 items, to the minute, by and large, except for a few that to a fractions of an hour. And I now can take every one of those minutes. I can take 6 a.m. on day 5, based on the 2.54 billion years, and I can calculate what that would be from a scientific point of view. So I take those 17 events and I place them to the minute, and then I just multiply a day by 2.54 billion, and I get my answer. So as you're running around the timeline here, if you go to day 5, these are 12 hours of darkness and 12 hours of light. If you go to 6 a.m., which would be the 12 hours of light, that was 10.23 billion years after creation. And so on for every item. So that's exactly what I did. I just put it through the Excel spreadsheet to see what would happen. The true story, by the way, is I only did the age of the universe. And I had a... Because of my work, I could only book holidays a year in advance. I had a one-week kayak trip with my nephews that I wasn't going to miss. So I computed the age of the universe. I had a bunch of science books, and I had a photocopy of Bereshit. This was too heavy, so I just took Bereshit with me. Went kayaking, no cell phone, nothing. Just VHF to hear the weather report. and I calculated all the other ones, and I didn't know how old the Milky Way was. You know, I'd been to school 30 years ago. I had no idea how old the Milky Way was. I knew the sun roughly, but I didn't know any of the other numbers. And I came back with all my numbers done, and I immediately got on the internet, and out of the 17, 16 match within all scientific measurement error. That's a true story. So that's shown on this slide. What I've done on this slide is I've taken the Genesis account in days, multiplied it out by the 2.5 billion years, and put it side by side with the science numbers. Now, every science number I showed you on the first slide had a margin of error. They're not exact. So the 13.8 that I told you the universe was is not really that. It's a range. I didn't put all the ranges because it makes the slide unreadable. So all of these numbers on this slide fit within the scientific error. So when you multiply out the days of creation, you get an age of the universe of 13.743 billion years, which the science numbers have been moving around, but they've always included 13.74 in the middle. They remeasure these numbers every year. When you calculate the age of the sun, you get 4.79. And science believes that the moon is about 50 million years younger than the sun. And we saw the reference less than 2/3 of an hour. If a day is 2.5 billion years, an hour is about 100 million years. 2/3 of an hour is about 70 million years. So, and so on. All the way through the first life, 3.52 billion, that's Let the Waters Teem at the beginning of day 5. That's when we find all the fossils. And then there's not much action in terms of animals until day 6. So nothing happens for about 1 billion or 2 billion years, and science can't understand that at all. And then bang, the animals show up at 500, so-called the Cambrian explosion, 530 million years ago. We go from microscopic life for 2 billion years to the oceans being absolutely full of all kinds of stuff and so on. Things about this big. There's no explanation for that from evolution because it's too fast. Coincides exactly in time. I left man out because it's complicated, and please come to the next lecture for man. It's a whole other story. So, like I said, this is the match. There's one that doesn't match, and we can talk about that at the end if you're interested. But all the other ones match. The one that doesn't match is not a measurement, it's theory. But it's pretty good theory, so I really want it to match, but it doesn't match. So I got this far, and I said, okay, well, you know, I don't have a problem with the timelines, and I always expected it to work out. I've been thinking about this since my bar mitzvah, off and on, but I couldn't find an approach to it. But then I got terribly disappointed. And the reason I got disappointed is because science has now come up with really good theories to explain all this naturally. And the most famous scientists of our current time, Hawking, has written a book to try and prove that there's no God. And it's selling about 1 million times better than my book, which drives me crazy. I can't read it. I've read parts of it, but it makes me too mad, so I can't read it. Because his arguments are just ridiculous. You should stick to science. Anyway, the question is, science has really good explanations for this, and we read last week that God said, God said, God said. So why should science be able to explain what God says? So that was the next question. And this is when it got interesting. So we have the concept, as hopefully you're aware, that God has many names. Okay? Sometimes we just call him our Father, our King for a month. But he has, of course, his essential name, which we're not allowed to say, Hashem, and he has a bunch of other names. And the concept of names is something which you use when you have an infinite being. And, of course, we're made in God's image, so our soul's infinite, so we have the same concept, so we can talk about it. So I have many names. I'm an engineer, CEO, I heard today, Daniel, father, teacher, whatever, all these names. And they're just labels. I don't need them, but people that are talking to me need them to say, okay, this is what you are today. It's the same concept with God. So there's no way to describe God, and we don't know what his essential name means, So we have labels. We says, okay, now he's being acting like a king. Now we want him to act like a father because we did a lot of sins and we need to be forgiven. Now he's acting with gevura, with judgment. And now he's acting with hesed, with mercy. So it's a well-developed concept in our sources, and it says that whenever God is narrating in the Torah, whatever name is narrating, that's what's coming down. That's the divine power that's coming down. So if he's narrating with judgment, it's judgment that's coming down. You read about that yesterday. In the flood, anytime he brings the flood, he's in his name of judgment. And you may have noticed that every time he talks to Noah, he's got a different name. He's got his name of mercy. So he's bringing judgment when he's making the flood. He's bringing mercy when he's trying to save Noah. So we have to go to each section of the Torah and see what name is being used. And that gives us a really good hint as to what is going on. And we're lucky that in chapter 1 of Genesis, there's only one name of God being used. As I said yesterday, in Noah, there's two names and they keep flipping. So that story is much harder. That's next hour. It's only one name of God being used. It's the name Elohim. And it's usually translated as judgment, but that's not the science translation of it. Ramban had figured a lot of this out. He gives it the translation master of all forces. That's the translation of that name. Its numerical value is the same as the numerical value of nature. So what is explained in our sources is that this particular narration with this name means that God decided for whatever, some of the kids asked me why, I said, no idea. God decided for whatever reason that when he was creating the universe, he was going to stick with his laws of nature, which of course he created. So he was going to do everything under the laws of nature. He wasn't going to cheat, violate the laws of nature. All the balls were going to roll downhill. He wasn't going to make anything roll uphill. He was sticking with nature. He doesn't have to do that. He doesn't do that in a lot of places. He goes outside of nature, and then we can't understand it easily. If he sticks within nature, we can understand it because that's what we see. So in Parsha Noah, for example, he goes outside of nature to save Noah. And we can talk about it later, but there's no way that ark could have survived that flood. It needed divine assistance if you look at the engineering of it. And we have we know exactly what it was made, how big it was, and so on. So in this account, we are being told that God is sticking with nature. He's not going to violate nature for whatever reason. The second thing we're being told is that almost every of the Hebrew words in the account are to take something and make something else. So I take wood and I make a chair. I take hydrogen and I make a star. I take a bunch of ingredients and I cook a new dish. It's something to something else. There's only three exceptions to that. Everything you read last week was something to something else. You have to look at the Hebrew words with the help of Rashi and so on. But it's something to something else. So what we have in the creation account is something, with three exceptions, just leave those aside for a minute, something to something else under the laws of nature. That is the definition of science. Science is trying to explain how something became something else under laws of nature. And they're trying to discover those laws of nature, which we've discovered the four forces on it. So the whole creation account, with the three exceptions, is going to be completely understood through science. God is telling us, don't be surprised that Hawkins comes to the conclusion he figured it all out. Don't be surprised that Darwin comes to the conclusion he figured it out. Everything was made within nature, and with three exceptions, everything was made something to something else. Is that clear? That's my main point. I'm going to go through the exceptions in a minute. That's why science is successful. Science is not successful explaining the flood, but science is very successful explaining this because that's the way God decided. Now, here's the cool thing. There are today four things that science is struggling with. There are many things that science is struggling with, but they're little problems. Like, why don't the star distribution come out exactly right? We gotta tweak a few more parameters. But there's big questions that science just is a little clueless about. Four big questions. One, they think they're going to solve in the next 10 years. The other three, they're not so sure. So there's three times in the creation account where the word bara is used. You recognize the first one, Bereshit bara Elohim. And bara is translated by all the sages. By the way, I have a source for everything I've said. A kosher, you know, well-recognized source for everything I've said, except the number 7,000, which I haven't explained. But everything else I'm saying is traceable to people that know what they're doing. The 7,000, I have sources for it too, but they're not as accepted. So the word bara in our sources says that he took nothing, meaning nothing physical, because God's everywhere, but nothing physical, and he made something. Still under the laws of physics, but he started with nothing and he made something. There's three times that word is used. It's only used once in the cosmology in the first 4 days, Bereshit bara, at the very, very beginning. So in the whole cosmology, the whole creation, forget about life for a minute, all the inanimate stuff, all the planets and stars and everything we're seeing, galaxies and so on, in that whole account, except for the very beginning, which Ramban defines as the creating space, time, and elementary particles, everything else took space, time, and elementary particles and put them together into stars and planets and everything else under the laws of physics, something from something. And today in the Big Bang Theory, we understand everything very well. I mean, there are pieces missing, but we understand everything pretty well, except the beginning. We are completely clueless about the beginning. Don't let anybody tell you that they know something about the beginning. We just don't know. There are 26, and everybody says it's related to God's name, but we don't know if it's 26 exactly, about 26 parameters that you have to put into the Big Bang Theory, which nobody knows where they came from, like the mass of a neutron or the mass of a proton or the strength of the gravitational field, the strength of the electric force, nuclear force, all of these things. They're all measured. Nobody can find much relationship between them. And if any of them is changed, nothing works. You don't get a universe in the computer when you run out the Big Bang Theory. So that beginning set of parameters is called a fine-tuning problem. Everything's tuned perfectly so that we're here today. If you change the tuning of any parameter, we don't get here through the theory. Of course, we get through God, but we don't get through the theory. And then there's two more. I'm going to talk about the human soul in the next hour, so I'm not going to go into it now. And the third one is the creation of large creatures, not microscopic creatures. That's not a bara. The Torah is predicting that science will be able to make life in the lab. Science is predicting they will be able to make life in the lab. Life, by the way, it means a self-replicating something, really small, less than a cell, something that self-replicates. That's what science defines as life. The Torah says that happened, something to something, and the laws of nature, so they'll do it in the lab. But going from the microscopic thing, whatever it was, we don't know in the Torah or in science, to something this big, that was a bara. And it happened right at one point, and that's how it happens in the fossil record. Like I said, there's 2 billion years of nothing going on, and then bang, it happens. So to recap and give you a chance to ask some questions, we have a timeline in our sources. We have a timeline in science. If you can believe my 1,000 times 7,000, if you don't believe it, at least see that it's a really simple number. I can't fudge it. The two reconcile with one exception. And the reading of the Torah says you will find really, really good theories to explain almost everything, and you'll be convinced that everything came around naturally. That happens to be the design of that chapter. So we shouldn't be confused by science being successful. The Torah is saying you will be successful. Yes?
Could you please speak into the microphone?
In terms of the Jewish calendar and the creation of the sun and the stars, you say you have good sources from the standpoint of the Torah as well.
Yes.
But it's rather clear that the rabbis, when they calculated Briat Olam, when the world was created, that they had the timeline that we have, the human time frame.
That's correct. So the general interpretation is that each day was a day, and therefore it's 6 days plus 5777, so it's 5777 approximately.
I'm not asking about the 6 days. Okay. I'm asking about the molad, When the Machzorim.
Yeah, I'm not changing any of that. That's totally fine. Yeah.
But how could it be fine if the sun was created so many billion years ago?
Because it all started counting from when we came to be. That's when we started. Our calendar stands on the birth of humanity.
It doesn't say that. We say Briyato Olam.
But the Rosh Hashanah is the sixth day of creation. The 25th of Elul is the first day of creation.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's what it says.
So I'm still not clear as to creation of time with the sun and the moon.
There could have been all this time, but it's only at 6,000 years ago it's actually later that we were commanded to make the calendar, right? And so on. Everything was there, and then we were commanded to make the calendar and to go by the moon and the sun and so on. So I don't see a contradiction there. But maybe we can take another, because we only got a few minutes. We can talk after.
I still don't understand what you're saying, because to me that's the big problem, that our calendar, the way we perceive it, the solar and the lunar calendar, do not include billions of years from when the sun was created. I'm going to leave that for you, but that to me, that's the critical. That is one of the critical issues.
Yeah. So we'll let somebody else. But we started counting after man. Yes. Somebody
can
want?
Can we get the name of your book, please?
Sure. I'm not very good at selling my books, but there's three books. The first book, the Genesis 1 code, is what I've just spoken about, and honestly, you can't do it any justice in this amount of time. The second book I'm going to talk about in the next hour, which is about man, called The Broken Gift. And the third one's not out yet. And they're on Amazon. They're about $3 on ebook and about $11 paperback, delivered overnight. Yeah, go ahead.
If you go back to your chart that you had of the timelines.
I got it.
Yeah, there we go. No, next one down. Okay. Is there an issue with the land plants being near the end and complex animals and herbivores being before that?
So, I get this question all the time. We are, in Bereshit, it talks about plants in day 3, and it talks about plants in day 6. Every commentary on day 3, with the exclusion of Rashi, says that those plants in day 3 did not sprout. The potential was there, but they didn't sprout. And they only sprouted when Adam prayed in day 6. Rashi disagrees with that, but everybody else does. If you go with a day 6, which is what I did, then the plants appear at the same time as the land animals. You can see there that the first plants were 420 million years ago, and the four-legged animals are 397. That's according to science. According to the Torah, the animals appeared in this time range, so starting at 426, and the plants exactly the same time range. If you go to the Talmud, it's the same hour. Starts at the same time, ends at the same time. In evolution, it's really hard to explain why plants and animals kind of, like the honey is the flower and the bee. You know, how do they synchronize themselves? But in the Torah, it is synchronized. Another question?
I like what you're trying to do. I don't find it convincing, and let me tell you why. Because you keep talking about sources as if there's a source. There are many sources over different periods of time. You don't correlate anything here with the underlying sources. I mean, why do you think they're just like one source? What does that mean? And we know, let me just follow up on that. There are Gemaras that tell us that Chazal were wrong. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi tells us he was wrong about certain calculations. We know that there were things that they believed, like the sun going underneath the earth, for example. You know, they didn't believe in...
Okay, let me answer your question. We got a minute. So, I didn't bring my couple hundred sources with me. And yes, when I'm constructing the timeline for what happened when, there are disagreements. I just told you one about the plants. I have like 10 or 15 sources say plants are day 6. I got Rashi saying they're day 3. There are those disagreements. out of the 17 things, about six, I don't think anybody would argue. The beginning is pretty clear. Here's the beginning, and here's today. The other 10, there are arguments. I explain in my book which source I use when, like anybody else. And a big part of the source issue is, and the plants is a really good example, I am looking for when science can find something. So the fact that there are plants in day three, but they haven't sprouted, doesn't do me any good, because I need the plant to sprout, to die, and to be fossilized. And then I can measure it. So I'm looking for a fossil. So that helps resolve some of those issues, but by no means it is as simple as I've presented. Hopefully in my book, I do give you some of the other issues, and of course the one that doesn't fit, which is with any source. One more question.
This is really unbelievable, but I'm just wondering, so much of science is now looking at quantum theory and probabilistic waves as opposed to particles, as opposed to anything really existing, as opposed to whether time really is a real force or real dimension. Are you reconciling at all quantum theory with Braysheet?
That's my fourth book. Yeah, it's actually quite unbelievable the amount of Kabbalistic work on the first two lines of Genesis, about 1,000+ pages so far, talking about what is time in more detail than science knows. And believe it or not, the speed of light being constant is in there. Now, people say, well, you knew the answer, so you found it, but it's... You'll see in my next book whenever I finish it. And quantum is there. You read about Tohu Babohu before Tikkun, the world of Tikkun. And that world is explained in the Kabbalah that was the world of elementary particles. And those elementary particles are not constrained by time and space. That's directly from our sources. That's basically quantum theory, right? It's only when you put those microscopic things in what Kabbalah calls vessels, which would mean us measuring them, for example, that they become into our world of Tikkun, and then they're constrained by time and space. So yeah, I am finding that. My plan is to go to each of the baras and write a book on it. For some reason, I'm going the wrong way here. Each of those three. So I'm working on the first one, the beginning, which is your question.
Perfect, thank you.
So for those of you who are staying, the next lecture we can do some more, but I'd like to give people a chance to switch around. Thank you.